When Superman appeared to be killed in battle with Doomsday, he was temporarily replaced by four other claimants to the name. In the intertitle event, Reign of the Supermen, far and away my favorite was John Henry Irons, who debuted in the June 1993 cover dated Superman, the Man of Steel, number 22. Mr. Johnson, nigh on 7 feet of solid muscle, but possessed of an obvious warmth, was entertaining a group of neighborhood boys on a Metropolis basketball court. Though dressed for game, Johnson was in storyteller mode, reciting the legend of John Henry. Afterward, Zoid talked about how he couldn't see the big deal about a guy working himself to death. His friend Keith explained, "He went up against something everybody knew couldn't be beat, and beat it all the same. He's cool, sort of like Superman." Zoid figured Keith was just sold on the production values of Mr. Johnson's Darth Vader voice. It was the last thing he would say, as Zoid's young frame was devastated in a drive-by as gangbangers let rip with a high-tech rifle. Mr. Johnson bolted to guard the other boys from harm, carrying them to safety. No one else was injured, but the kids were horrified by Zoid's smoldering skeleton. Johnson chased after the hoods on foot, cutting across an empty lot and leaping at their speeding sedan. Johnson wrapped his arms around the rifle that had been thrust out of the passenger window, warping it with his awesome strength. However, the driver rammed against a brick wall, leaving Johnson bleeding in an alleyway. Later, Johnson was visited at the hospital by Keith and his mother, Myra, all gussied up for the occasion. Keith wished Superman was still alive to deal with Zoid's killers, and Johnson told him the tale of how he had once met the Man of Steel. Working on a skyscraper and feeling low from past mistakes, Johnson was startled to see one of his fellows fall off a girder. Johnson grabbed a cable and swung out in time for the save, but the hook holding Johnson's line gave. Free falling from a deadly height, Johnson soared past, flashed before his eyes. Though it was not in an end, thanks to Superman's mid-air intervention, Johnson told the Kryptonian,
"I owe you my life."
To which the hero replied,
"Then make it count for something."
Not long after, Superman was engaged in mortal combat with the otherworldly juggernaut Doomsday for the fate of Metropolis. Johnson tried to help, but ended up buried under rubble for his trouble.
"I must have been a little out of my head, because I clawed my way out, still thinking I had to stop Doomsday."
Released from the hospital, Johnson was troubled by his promise to Superman, Zoid's unsolved murder, and a specific instrument of death. Johnson chatted with Rosie, the neighborhood fortune teller, before unlocking the basement below her building. There, Johnson began forging a suit of armor.
"John Henry fought the machine and won. What I'm fighting is a deadlier kind of machine. One I helped put in motion. One I'm going to stop, even if it kills me."
Meanwhile, the thugs behind Zoid's killing had followed Johnson home and tossed a Molotov cocktail through the basement window. The old building lit up like a tinderbox when the bottle struck an oil reservoir, and Rosie screamed for her life. Johnson donned his blue-gray armor, emblazoned with a Superman shield and flowing red cape. Impractical, maybe, but when his sledgehammer pounded through Rosie's door, the ensemble made an impression.
"The Man of Steel is coming through."
Rosie was carried to safety, and at first seemed to have tweaked to her savior's dual identity. However, as she later explained to reporters, what she actually thought she recognized was the soul of Superman having taken up residence in a newly available body.
"Have you ever heard of a walk-in spirit?"
Among the reporters was Lois Lane, who would find solace with her friend Jeb Friedman at this latest claimant to the resurrection of the man she loved. Pa Kent was laid up when the news hit the television, and it set his battered heart racing. Alexander Luthor watched the report with a very personal interest as well, dispatching investigators to follow up on Rosie's claims. Luthor was also interested in Henry Johnson, and super weapons someone had been circulating on the streets. The new Man of Steel tracked down the creeps who killed Zoid and crashed their pad. The leader, Dutch, blasted one of his own in half to get at the hero with his super weapon. As the Man of Steel worked his way out of a caved-in brick wall, still clutching the top half of the hood, he recognized the
Toastmasters, BG-80s, my design.
Johnson flashed back to brutal killings in an oil state, U.S. military brass congratulating him on a job well done. While today bald with an earring, Johnson in the day wore glasses, a flat top, and a pocket protector on his suit. Johnson also remembered the death of his grandfather years earlier, blood having landed on a framed picture of Martin Luther King Jr. The Man of Steel came back strong, firing rivets from a wrist gauntlet that pinned Dutch to a wall. Questioning began, as Dutch gave up the White Rabbit as the supplier of his Toastmaster. Elsewhere, a trampy-looking woman with white hair had a Toastmaster in her hands and used it to assassinate Dutch from afar. The White Rabbit's helpers questioned the logic of not trying to take out the new Superman while she had the chance.
"He's potentially more profitable than both of you combined."
Alexander Luthor's forces had only managed to learn the name White Rabbit after a day's effort, perhaps based on the number of bolt holes that keep her secure. Luthor would know more. Steel was by Louise Simonson, John Bogdanov, and Dennis Janke. This was the first full appearance of John Henry Irons after his cameo debut in Adventures of Superman number 500. It's a dynamic read, although the honkies responsible for the book could have maybe pulled back on all the words ending in apostrophes. I headed over to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, the newsstand app, to make sure I had the chronology right between the Man of Steel annual and the Man of Steel issues. And it's funny seeing how important Reign of the Superman was into making me a DC Comics fan. Adventures of Superman number 500 came out the first week of June at the same time as Batman number 494, another chapter of Nightfall, followed the next week by Detective Comics number 661. And then the week following introduced two more of the four Reign of the Superman men, The Last Son of Krypton in Action Comics number 687, and The Metropolis Kid in Adventure Comics number 501. The former looked like a very 90s version of Superman, was cold, emotionless, and violent. The latter was a very 90s version of Superboy, but don't call him boy, he was Superman, don't you know? And in that same week was Batman number 495, followed the next week by Superman number 78, and Superman the Man of Steel number 22, which introduced the cyborg Superman and the Man of Steel. And then the week after that, yet another Detective Comics number 662. So if you strip away Reign of the Superman and Nightfall chapters, the books I was buying at this time were Deathstroke the Terminator, Green Lantern number 41, which featured Deathstroke the Terminator, and that's why I bought it, Eclipso, which I'd started picking up because I'd gotten hooked by the Eclipso event annual of 1992, New Titans, the main book that got me trying DC in the early 90s again, which of course led me to those Deathstroke appearances, Sandman number 50, Batman Legend of the Dark Knight number 46, which I was only buying because I was into Catwoman and the art of Russ Heath, Justice League Task Force number 1, which I bought because I was a fan of Nightwing from the Titans, Team Titans, I bought Green Arrow number 75 because I was a fan of Speedy from the Titans, and then finally in the last week of the month, Lobo Annual number 1, my first Bloodlines annual. So if you look at the streams here, what you basically have is a Titans fan who is mostly buying books related to that franchise, who then began picking up Superman and Batman titles because of their big events. But the fact is, I didn't continue with either Superman or Batman's books very far beyond those events. They just didn't manage to hook me. And it would have been fairly easy to continue to separate myself from the DC Universe by just focusing on Titans titles. So the books that really drew me into the expanding DC Universe were the Bloodlines annuals.
Me now on a fun journey, a journey that will take us many years into the past, where a long time ago, character Superman first graced the pages of Action Comics, but there was technology more advanced, and it brought forth a race of moviegoers, men and women like ourselves, but advanced to the absolute peak of human entertainment. They wanted to see their character adapted in other media. They made him the Man of Screen. Man of Screen podcast will chronicle the adventures of Superman on the big screen and the small screen, starting with the Fleischer Shorts, the Kirk Allen movie serials, Superman and the Mole Men, the 1950s television series, The Adventures of Superman, the Christopher Reeve movies, Lois and Clark, Superman the Animated Series, and more. Come check out the Man of Screen podcast, coming in March to manofscreen.podomatic.com.
Bloodline's alien ship crashed somewhere in a swamp within driving distance of Metropolis. The monster swiftly camouflaged the vessel while displaying shorthand personality through traits. Glonth equals glutton, Angon equals angry rebel, etc. When a biker gang approached the crash site, Angon ignored calls for discretion to rip into the gang and feast. Assuming the form of an athletic Caucasian female with long brown hair in a top knot, Angon stole a motorcycle and announced he was going to town alone to feed on
the pigs who burrow there!
In a Metropolis slum, John Henry Irons worked out at the Iron Factory gym, spotted by his buddy Tom O'Brien. Since Tom referred to John by his real first name, rather than his alias, the pair presumably had a long history between them. Either that or it was a screw-up, since Tom's mom knows Irons as Henry Johnson. Tom was wearing a Bleeding Superman Shield t-shirt his sister had hand-painted, because there was no money in the household for store-bought memorial gear. Knowing what a big fan Tom was of Superman, his little brother Petey had helped touch it up, and the kids gave it to Tom as a Father's Day present. Life had been hard since their father died, but Tom made sure ends were met. Tom asked how John was holding up after his injuries chasing Zoid's killers.
Doing fine.
The pair turned their attention to Tom's mullet-headed little bro, Petey. The 12 or so lad, spitting image of Tom, had gotten a paper route before school to help out the family. John defended the initiative, but Tom worried it might hurt Petey academically. Tom had to return to work at the gym, but John walked with Petey for a ways, demonstrating his knowledge of trajectories through well-tossed newspapers. Petey hero-worshipped Tom,
the strongest guy at the gym next to John,
but there was some concern he might also follow Tom's example of dropping out of school. Suddenly, Angon rode by on her motorcycle, nearly running Petey down without even slowing her roll, eventually finding herself in a filthy alley. Angon attacked an indigent and sucked out his spinal fluid, which had a slightly sour taste. The monster then hid the body down a storm drain, which proved so convenient Angon began using it routinely. Mary O'Brien was walking home with her groceries when the skeptic was dragged into Rosie the Psychic's apartment for a free tarot reading.
Father Kavner says tarot cards are Christian.
Rosie divined tragedy was due to befall Tom, and rushed Mary out the door to try enlisting Henry Johnson's help with the matter. Irons wasn't at home, and by the time he returned, the sweetness of Tom's spinal fluid had been suckled by Angon. Unaware of such, Irons donned his recently engineered suit of armor and flew a patrol. The Man of Steel series' writer had previously scripted X-Men-related books, whose readers might recognize the sewer-dwelling mutants dubbed Warlocks and the Underworlders who trolled under Metropolis. These subterranean derelicts discovered Tom's body on a mound of corpses. Bowen O'Brien was reanimated as a horrific form whose hair had been replaced by blades all over his body. They panicked. Tom couldn't remember who he was and feared he might have killed all those people himself. The Steel Superman was soon on his trail, talking with the Underworlders and finding the tatters of Tom's personalized t-shirt. The Man of Steel ran straight into Angon on his way out of the sewer and found his defenses useless against its tough red hide. However, a spike fired from Steel's gauntlet into Angon's tender mouth was enough to send the nasty creature scurrying away until a battle strategy could be joyfully devised. Tom's mother couldn't sleep for worry, and neither could Petey, who snuck out of their apartment to find his brother. Maggie Sawyer and the Special Crimes Unit of Metropolis had followed up on the Underworlders' reports of the mass grave, an unusual variation on vampirism, and some kind of spiked werewolf. The cops had the tatters of Tom's shirt as evidence, but Petey overheard the conversation and stole the remains to protect his brother's identity. Angon spotted the youth on the run from the scene and hoped this
red hair
would taste as good as the last. The Steel Superman finally found Tom, but O'Brien was too confused, frightened, and blinded by self-pity to listen to reason at first. Tom's blades ripped away portions of Steel's armor, both intentionally and inadvertently, as you couldn't touch Tom without connecting with his blades. O'Brien eventually listened to reason, but not before a lot of property damage had been inflicted, bringing police to the scene. The Man of Steel ignored officers' demands and fled the scene with his friend in precarious tow. After a quick payphone call to a worried mother, who Tom still didn't recognize, the heroes learned Petey was missing. O'Brien wrapped what was left of his clothes in barbed wire to keep the book from going mature readers, and a new search began. Outside the Iron Factory, Petey was attacked by Angon, and did a far better job of holding back the beast than his elder brother had. First beating at Angon's maw with a lead pipe, Petey next thought to throw it through a gym window to set off its alarm, hopefully drawing aid. This alerted the Steel Superman, already en route, who carried Petey to safety. Tom threw himself at Angon, his blades doing more of a number on the alien's armor than anything in John Henry Irons' arsenal. Petey jumped back into the fray, but Tom expelled the blades on his arms and chest to allow him to safely carry Petey out of the dang way again, where neither O'Brien's nor the Man of Steel's weapons could turn Angon back on their own. Irons had Tom fire blades into the alien's chest, and rivets drove them deeper into Angon's hide. Already hurting and flanked by cops, Angon finally decided it was all
too much.
After the creature disappeared, Petey was dismayed to learn Tom didn't know who he was.
But I'd like to. You're a cool kid, you know that?
The brothers hugged, and Petey figured,
you took care of us all those years, and now we're going to take care of you.
Maggie Sawyer allowed Tom to walk, but O'Brien was hot to find Angon and return to normal. Petey thought Tom looked cool as is, figuring he'd become a superhero.
I'm going to call you Edge. You'll be awesome.
Angon licked wounds, figuring the other aliens would be angry if she allowed their numbers to be depleted by dying in glorious battle. It was still pissed, though, and set on feeding some more. Cutting Edge was by Louise Simonson, Eddie Newell, and Mike Barrero. This was the second Bloodlines annual, which I bought new, and found entirely inferior to Lobo Annual No. 1. Neither Alan Grant's pedestrian script nor Christian Alami's biz impersonation have stood the test of time, and this book wasn't nearly as awful as I remembered. I believe this was my third or fourth time reading this particular annual. It was better than I'd remembered it. Louise Simonson basically creates a whole Lifetime movie around this kid, and while I don't think it would have supported a series, and in fact I think that was one of the problems I had with her work on the Steel ongoing book, was it was too much soap opera. If they use Edge in the upcoming Bloodlines Hostile Takeover miniseries, this backstory could be handy. Thanks largely to the art of Eddie Newell, this annual has a strong horror vibe to it. The story's a bit too soft to sell that, but that's not his fault. Eddie Newell never became that big of a name in comics. He was about at the wrong time. His style had a 70s vibe to it, but it was quite good, and he was good at drawing real people and diverse body types. The only notable run he had was in the 90s Black Lightning series. Today, he does a lot of commission work. I believe this was the second appearance of Steel, the John Henry Irons version, and something of a sophomore slump. Newell's art remains rough and uneven, with muddy coloring by Glenn Whitmore, but it's not without its charms. The story reads like an innocent throwback to the 40s boy comics in an unholy union with 90s ultraviolence. Annoying at the time, I now find Petey the can-do hero of this piece. Edge was quite the whiner, but I'd be a sad sack too if my pubic hair looked like a porcupine. Following his debut adventure with Steel in Superman the Man of Steel Annual No. 2, Edge turned up in Eclipso Annual No. 1, alongside Nightblade, Sparks, Loose Cannon, and Anima, a new loosely associated team that had arrived to recruit the emerging new blood Prism. Instead, Prism fights the team, does pretty darn well on his own, at one point microwaving Edge with infrarays. Eventually, though, the group manages to calm Prism down, and Edge draws exposition from previous Bloodlines annuals in the sand with one of his little hair razors. The whole lot of them decide to team up as they battled Angon and Eclipso, and at that point they continued on together. That same group was in the opening scenes of Bloodbath No. 1, and that team was the first on the scene after defeat of the mainstream DC heroes in Bloodbath No. 2. The real Superman was the sole escapee from an attempted assault on the Parasite's home base. Edge explained to Superman that the New Bloods had been drawn to the site through some sort of calling they all felt, and were geared for a final battle with the Parasites. Edge at least contributed to their defeat, though not in a major way. Steel turned up in group cameo shots from Showcase 94 No. 12, which introduced the New Blood super team called the Blood Pack, who went on to a four-issue miniseries, the final issue of which Edge got one last cameo, and that's the last time he's ever appeared. I'm surprised by this, because Edge seems like the perfect guy to kill in some big crossover. I mean, it looks like a fair amount of work was put into his backstory by Louise Simonson. He seems like a nice enough guy and all, but he totally looks like a supervillain, and not an especially inspired one at that. Even as the guy who liked the Bloodlines event enough to create a blog spotlighting it and release podcast episodes for each of the New Bloods, when you say the name Edge, I think of the creator-owned character by Stephen Grant and Gil Kane that came out of Bravura, I believe about a year or so after this one. And even as I record this podcast, I have to stop and keep checking to make sure that that's the guy's name. It's not a great trademark. I think Edge would be a good guy to have as a sympathetic villain, but the time to do that was during Steel's ongoing series that spun out of Reign of the Supermen, not 22 years later.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garrett. Plain, simple, Garrett.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will surely become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell. Oh, I love a woman in uniform.
Only on TrueTrueFreaks.com.
In Superman, the Man of Steel No. 23, gangbangers in Metropolis's suicide slum were videotaping themselves showing off their new Toastmaster assault rifles and stalking the Man of Steel for a showdown. Iron John was aware of these shark enforcers and lured them to an unpopulated area to drop the hammer. The Man of Steel questioned one hood about the White Rabbit's whereabouts, who was killed by another to keep him from squealing, but the little idiot videotaped himself committing murder. Iron John brought the moron in, and later, Lex Luthor II, bought the tape before the police knew what they had. Luthor's right-hand man Happerson had the tape analyzed and augmented until a clue was found indicating the rabbit was held up in the Spire, the downtown Metro Spire Hotel. Meanwhile, the White Rabbit wanted to have a talk with John Henry Irons, aka Henry Johnson, so she had her security blocks removed to make herself easy to find. At the Daily Planet, Jimmy Olsen argued that none of these new supermen reigning over Metropolis were the real deal, and Lois Lane agreed, but she was distracted by Jeb trying to move into Clark's vacated place. Jimmy was pleased that a gang skirmish between the Reavers, the Skulls, and the Man of Steel took precedence for Lois. Over the sight, the new Superboy mugged for helicopter news cameras before heading into battle. Gunfire the Metropolis Kid Dodge struck the planet's chopper, killing the pilot and sending Lois out the side door. The Man of Steel caught her, and upon landing was sworn by press. Lois wouldn't let Iron John go without questioning what claim he was making to Superman's legacy, as the other three pretenders were falling all over themselves trying to convince the world they're Superman. This Man of Steel made no such claim, and was just here to help. Iron John was also here to lecture, as he took Superboy aside and pointed out his fault in the pilot's death. Superboy at first denied responsibility, but the talk shook his resolve. Lois watched from afar and approved, wondering if Superman's soul might have walked into the Man of Steel's body.
This one feels right.
Lex Luthor II made contact with the Man of Steel, informing him about the spire while secretly planning a bug on his armor. At the hotel, John Henry Irons was confronted by Dr. Angora Lapin, who had years prior provided computer imaging expertise while Irons was developing the BG-80s for the government. The pair had once been lovers, but now Irons was a penitent superhero, and Lapin was selling the BG-80s as Toastmasters under the guise of the White Rabbit. Angora had managed to retrieve Irons' designs from his computer, and once Iron John rejected her offer of a renewed partnership, she fired on him with their wares. The Man of Steel was thrown into a gas tanker, where he was sort of but not really rescued by Superboy. Iron John explained that because he designed the BG-80s, he felt as responsible for the pilot's death as Superboy. The White Rabbit was even more so, but she escaped before either Superman could capture her. While Lois continued to wonder about the virtue of Clark Kent she had seen in the Man of Steel, Lex Luthor II was investigating John Henry Irons, a weapons designer wanted by the feds. Ambush was by Louise Simonson, John Bogdanov, and Dennis Janke. Finally, we move on to August 1993's Man of Steel number 24.
This is Neil Watts, live from WLEX Coast City. The WLEX news chopper is circling the impact crater in the Coast City Mall parking lot. Whoever made it came hard and fast. Holy smoke! Inside the crater are two of the Supermen, the Man of Steel and the visors of one who calls himself the last son of Krypton. Minutes ago, they were brawling in Metropolis. Like thousands of viewers, I'm asking myself, what are they doing in California? And what is this fight all about?
A process server had tried to deliver cease and desist papers to both men, as someone seemed to be legally shoring up the Superman name for themselves. When the last son of Krypton tried to fry the worker for the slight, Steel came to the defense. The Kryptonian took Steel into outer space, and the pair crash-landed on the other side of the country. Steel began to pound the last son, repeatedly pointing out all the things he had done that Superman would never do. While the art clearly showed Steel battering the pseudo-Superman senseless, editorially mandated, thought balloons had the Kryptonian insisting Steel's display was foolish for one whose power he so clearly dwarfed. The last son of Krypton came to the realization that he lacked the human compassion the Man of Steel had in abundance, and that there must be more to Superman than power. When police arrived, the Kryptonian bid Steel return to Metropolis, as he answered cries for help there in Coast City. Team Luthor raided a Toastmaster factory in Metropolis. Gangbangers with BG-80s penetrated some troopers' body armor, but the thugs had no defense against the gas attack. The White Rabbit looked on from an office, putting off her pudgy nerdlinger aide, Graham, to hear,
"What little Lexi wants with me?"
Luthor II heard the word on the rabbit, and while obfuscating the facts with his girlfriend, Supergirl, Matrix version, also had Steel offered a plane ride home.
"If I can't own you, Man of Steel, I want you out of the picture, permanently."
Lois Lane was still coming to terms with Clark Kent's death, as his apartment would soon be up for grabs, and his job at the Daily Planet was already given to Ron Troop. Her friend Jeb Friedman was still around to console Lois, and he thought to himself,
"If the only way I can have you is on the rebound, I'll take what I can get."
Lex Luthor, still keeping up his Aussie shtick while prancing around in a clone body, negotiated have the White Rabbit and her gang ambush the Man of Steel upon arrival at Metropolis International Airport. When Toastmasters and Dr. Bunny's enforcer Digit couldn't stop Steel, the White Rabbit finally unleashed Graham. The portly Poindexter ripped off his glasses and already undersized striped shirt to become a blob so rotund he looked to have eaten a few Frederick J. Dukes. However, Steel's boot jets worked to singe Graham's belly, allowing the hero to catch his rabbit and fly her away for questioning. The BG-80s were being produced at the old abandoned Ordster plant, at least in part, but the White Rabbit was willing to sacrifice a digs if she could snare Steel in a trap. A bomb destroyed the plant, but the Man of Steel managed to escape, wondering about why the missing White Rabbit would reference,
"Giving me Luthor for a present? He's supposed to be one of the good guys."
Luthor II thought it a shame such an attractive woman had appeared to perish, but he had access to her henchmen, a BG-80 he could replicate, and the secret identity of John Henry Irons he could manipulate. Impact was by Louise Simonson, John Bogdanov, and Dennis Janke. As a Martian Manhunter fan, it always bugs me when people try to use the Manhunter from Mars as though it were a nickname, instead of just rearranging the character's main name that we know him by. So when John Henry Irons was introduced and they were referring to him as the Man of Steel and he appeared in the book Superman the Man of Steel, that bugged me in a similar fashion. I wanted him to have his own name and his own identity. On one of the early covers, he was referenced with his own logo as Iron John. And while I could definitely see the jokes that could be made about a metal latrine, I also recognize the historical significance. This is a guy who's based on the legend of John Henry, the steel-driving man, a railway worker who fought against automation of his job in the form form of the Inky Poo. So it makes sense to want to reference that since the Man of Steel's alter ego was based on that legend. But then they ultimately went with the name Steel, which has never sat well with me because there was already a white man named Steel that had his own book in the 70s, and a version of that same character has been revived in every decade since. It's bad enough that John Henry Irons, one of the most prominent African-American heroes in the DC Comics, starts off his career as an intentional, obvious derivation of Superman, but then as he tries to forge his own identity, it's still compromised by having a secondhand label from a Bronze Age washout that also serves as a constant reminder of the Man of Steel. Also, Steel has this weird circumstance where he's kind of a combination of the big three Avengers. He's got the heart and the good-natured personality of Captain America, but also the super hammer and cape of Thor, and then of course the suit of armor and engineering prowess of Iron Man. So once again, he's hugely indebted to a bunch of white superheroes. I remember back in my days on the DC message boards, one commenter pointed out that he felt like Steel was the superhero that Cyborg, Victor Stone, should have grown up to become. And 20 years later, I think he was right. Cyborg was created to be a member of the new Teen Titans, so his whole origin was wrapped up into the origins of that team, but he still received his abilities and identity from his parents. And while Cyborg certainly existed in science fiction and comics long before Victor Stone, his take was early enough and independent enough for him to really own that identity. Plus, DC has been trying to push Victor Stone as part of the Justice League as a founding member, which is an important iconic status that I don't think the Victor Stone character has ever earned, because he was and remains defined by being the black guy on superhero teams instead of being an iconic hero in his own right. Meanwhile, I think John Henry Irons is a wonderful character, very well realized, someone who's brilliant and self-motivated. So basically, if you could combine Steel with Cyborg, I think you could create a truly iconic African-American superhero that stands up in comparison to anybody else in the Justice League. And that's the sort of thing that I had hoped you'd see happen in the New 52, where they would figure out the things that never quite worked about their universe, but instead they just made the DC universe a rehash of 1990s Wildstorm comics. Plus, they made Cyborg dependent on Darkseid for his origins, and one of his main claims to fame right now is that he integrated a boom tube into his technology, so he's the guy who teleports the Justice League around. Whereas for me, when I would read The Man of Steel with John Henry Irons in it, I was reading that book for John Henry. I like that character so much, I find him so much more interesting as a comic book protagonist than even Superman, that it drives me nuts that I can never take Steel as being his own man and not being this dependent element in the Superman mythos. That also helped to explain why, when it was revealed that none of the Reign of the Supermen were the real Steel deal, and Kal-El actually came back in Superman The Man of Steel number 25, I continued to read that book for only a few more issues, and as soon as Steel was no longer featured in it, I think Man of Steel was one of the first of the Superman titles I dropped after Reign of the Superman. I like Louise Simonson as a writer, and I really appreciated that she was trying to show the more street-level Metropolis through her Steel stories. But as Superman came back and she was telling straight Superman stories again, I lost all interest. I also think that John Bogdanov is one of the best Superman artists, but probably not the best guy to draw Superman with a freaking mullet. For years at DC Comics, when you had black characters in superhero books, they were basically drawn like white people with afros and colored differently. So even though there were some elements in John Bogdanov's art from these issues that I could definitely see being objectionable, I do think that Bogdanov brought a real authenticity to these 1993 era urban, quotation marks, stories. There were elements of caricature in these stories, but that's part of John Bogdanov's style. And I love that big cartoonist, voluptuous, afrocentric quality that these stories had. As much as I like John Bogdanov drawing Superman, I thought that he drew Steel's world much better, and I wanted to see him continue to work on that. And instead, when Steel got his own spin-off series, Bogdanov was merely a plotter. An artist was chosen that was nowhere near as good at handling the material as Bogdanov, and it felt like they really dropped the ball on this character, because, as a for instance, you have Keith White in the first issue featuring the character. Now, this was a black orphan that was introduced in Man of Steel number 1 and popped up sporadically for a good chunk of the series. And his guardian, Myra Allen, was around for about 5 appearances. Keith White was eventually adopted by Perry White, and he showed up for a number of issues before finally being blown off after a 1995 KKK story. But here's this guy in the first, John Henry Irons, full-length comic book, and he never pops up in an issue of Steel. It's also funny to me that you have this connection between John Henry Irons and Perry White. People were fan-casting Lawrence Fishburne as Steel for years, and then he ends up playing Perry White instead. And of course, Myra Allen never appears again. Jeb Friedman, this guy who apparently existed only to throw a kink in Lois Lane's romance, romantic life after the apparent death of Clark Kent. That guy could have shown up in Steel at some point, but he sort of fell off. I don't know if Rosie the Psychic was around before these early Steel stories. I don't remember her showing up in any Superman books afterwards, and she didn't show up in Steel. It seemed like an awful lot of work went into Edge and the O'Brien family, so maybe they could have had them move with Steel to Washington, D.C. at some point, but they never turned up again. But my real trouble is with the White Rabbit. I thought that that was a very interesting femme fatale in the mold of a Will Eisner character. She was gorgeous and very distinctive in 1993. Things like her nose piercing just weren't seen that much in mainstream comics at that point. She moved differently. She had a different body type. She seemed like she was going to be a big deal for Steel, given that she dated back to his origins before he even picked up the armor. And yet she never turned up in the ongoing series. I feel like enough thought wasn't put into figuring out what they were going to do with Steel after they created that character. When he was spun off into his own book, he moved to Washington, D.C. They looked more heavily into his background in the business world, and they spent a lot of time with his family. But aside from coming up with a recurrent villain in Hazard, they didn't seem like they knew what to do with any of these things they'd set up, and they didn't use any of the stuff they'd established previously, so Steel just kind of farted around for the first 3 years of his series. And a lot of the potential I saw in that character sort of floated away with it. But I still love John Henry Irons, and I look forward to looking at this character again in future podcasts.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Mike. I'm trailing.
Man, it sure is great to be back to FCTC after such a long time.
Yes, it is, and we've been away so long.
Yeah, but real life and... You know what? I just can't do this.
Can't do what?
We have taken more breaks from this show than my wife has had in her entire life. I mean, we can talk about real life getting in the way.
Which it has.
But it's just not fair. So we're not going to joke around, and we're going to simply say that for the moment, we're back, and there's a lot of neat stuff to talk about.
Like season 2 of Lois and Clark.
And the death of Clark Kent.
And the launch of Superman the Man of Tomorrow.
And the return of Lex Luthor.
And the trial of Superman.
And Underworld Unleashed.
The show can still be found at the Superman homepage, as well as at the Fortress of Baletude.
And we're still part of the Superman Podcast Network.
So From Crisis to Crisis is back.
For now.
And it will still come out on Thursdays.
Most week at www.fortressofbaletude.com, www.supermanhomepage.com, or www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
This episode ran kind of long, so I'm going to try to keep this part short. We received social media love from Alan Middleton, Ange, Between the Pages, Cash Flag, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comic Reflections, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Ed Moore, and Ed Moore Jr., at Teal Productions, and at Miskatonic, Hicks, at Reading Hicks, Joseph Crawford, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Mark Sweeney, Michael Allen Carlisle, Nathaniel Hubbard, Paul Scavito, Richard Field, Scott Bachman, Siskoid, Son of Cthulhu, Trekker Talk Podcast, and Warlord Worlds Podcast. Coffee and Comics Blog tweeted, Layla, you got me on my knees. Kudos on another excellent Bloodlines episode. I'm officially hooked. Please tell me you will do character voices every episode. I'll probably do character voices in every episode. Siskoid noted, Frank does that a lot. Check out Martian Manhunter Podcast 2. Son of Cthulhu tweeted, pleasure was all on my end. Great job. Joseph Crawford offered, it's a great show. My new favorite podcast. You make the crappiest comics sound desirable. Currently adding Demon and Lobo issues to want list. Hey man, don't put that on me. I never recommended any Lobo comics, but there's a very solid Demon trade out now called Hell's Hitman, which covers the early appearances of the New Blood Hitman. So good stuff. And they're doing a second volume in the very near future too. I'm sure we're going to see a lot of DC's Garth Ennis material in print very soon, given the coming of the Preacher television adaptation on AMC. Siskoid wrote, oh, you're really going for it. Yeah, Layla is vaguely familiar, but I was a big Legion fan and bought most if not all of Bloodlines, so she should be a little more than vaguely familiar, especially since I think she looks familiar because I'm really thinking of C-list Firestorm villain Suicide Squad Mort Mindboggler. Ryan Daly sent out a tweet of possible interest. I found this Bloodline spinoff in my collection, being Gunfire number 0. His power is the ability to turn random things into guns.
Extreme!
Twitch Coffee and Comics Blog noted. Sure, the least 90s character ever, obviously. And Superman Captain Marvel noted. I thought maybe his power is pooping chains. If you enjoyed any of the background music from this episode, please contribute to their financial security and support the artist's productivity by paying illegally downloading the songs Black Steel by Tricky, The Razor's Edge by AC/DC, One Step Closer by Linkin Park, Time for Some Action by Redman, and Throw Your Guns by Onyx.
The preceding DC Comics related program is a non-profit fan production. Any copyrighted materials therein are believed covered under fair use, and no copyright infringement is intended. Please leave your comments on the DC Bloodlines blog, the Rollspine Podcast's WordPress page, via email at emailofdiabalu@yahoo.com, or you can tweet the host directly on the Twitters at Commander Blanks, spelled with an X. You can also talk to the whole Rolled Spine gang on the Twitters at Rolled Spine. We hope you enjoyed our little program, and remember,
spill the blood!